what is the author revealing to us about each of their characters? So Joseph, first of all. It tells us in 37 that Joseph is 17 years of age and still a youth. What he's saying is, what the author is saying is, Joseph is immature. He's 17 years old, and yet he's still a youth. He shouldn't be a youth at 17 years old. He's immature. And many reasons, right? We could definitely go into why is he mature here. Well, lots of different reasons, but the text tells us right here he's immature. But we also see that he's eager to tell the truth. How do we know? Two ways. We know that he gives a bad report to his father about his brothers, and we know about his dreams. So let's dive into those just a little bit. He gives a bad report. First of all, the bad report, the vocabulary here is actually meant to do harm to the brother's reputation. And the brothers that he's talking about here are just the sons of the concubines. But he is probably telling the truth. Why would we say that? Because we already know their character,
right?
We already know that their behavior shows that they work from anxiety. So we know that Joseph's bad report may be very true. And he's eager to do so in his immaturity. But there's different ways he could have done it. Think back to Ham in Genesis 9. The brothers there, they need to do the same thing as Joseph. They need to look at what's happening, what's the best thing. And they decide the best thing for Ham would be if they covered up the temptation for Ham to go through with his schemes, right? They could have woken up their father and said, hey, Dad, this is what Ham is trying to do, right? That's what Joseph does. But Ham's brothers do something differently because they're looking out for their brother. Joseph here wants to tell the truth, but he's not looking out for the interest of the brothers. In other words, he speaks the truth without love. And it highlights the discrepancy between the attachments. Joseph is very attached to his father, but he's not attached to his brothers. And so though he wants to tell the truth, he doesn't do it with attachment. He doesn't do it with love. And that is a gigantic piece that we need to understand about Joseph here.
Happens sometimes with younger people, I mean younger siblings, because the older ones are more mature, they have more freedom,
yep.
You know, they have things, they have the car.
So we see a little bit, we see some immaturity with Joseph. The second way that he expresses this idea of eagerness to tell the truth is through the sharing of his dreams. Right? He says, please listen to the dream which I have. Again, he's very eager to share this truth. I mean, think about a little kid. He wants to just tell all about it. But he does it without recognition of his brother's interest. Right? Because it says they hated him even more. He even does it a second time and includes his mother and father in it. By the way, here, mother would have been a concubine, not his mother's dead, right? All of this points to an immature generosity, right? He's generous. He wants to be able to tell the truth, but in an immature way because he has no consideration for how to do it in a way that it will build up others, right? It has no attachment, no connection to others. It's just, I want to tell the truth. He's so excited about telling the truth. So many times people look at this and say he's a tattletale. Yes, but, and I say that because Joseph's character here is partially good. In other words, he's generous. He wants to tell the truth. He wants to give it all out. But he has no maturity to that. He has no connection with others in his generosity. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the idea. And it should provoke us to ask. Oh, first of all, I should say, one of the reasons this is good, I read an article last week from Warren Buffett. You know who Warren Buffett is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so most successful man in America, Jeff Bezos, of course, is our richest man. Warren Buffett, different type of person. Just definitely has some very strict moral code. Mm-hmm. So they ask him a lot of times, how would you do this in business? How would you do this in business? He's the person that most people go to for business advice. And his business advice about leadership, the best leaders, what makes the best leaders? And he says three things make the best leaders. Number one, generosity. Number two, honesty. And what do we see here with Joseph? Generosity, wants to give it all out. Honesty, he wants to tell the truth. But the third thing that Warren Buffett says is selflessness. And this is where Joseph is lacking, right? He doesn't connect his generosity and his honesty with other people. He doesn't connect how it needs to be brought into a relationship. And so it should provoke us to ask ourselves and to ask God, have we allowed God to mold us with a character of generosity? That would be the first question, right? And if so, is my generous character still immature? Or even more likely, where is my generous character immature? In what ways do I want to tell the truth without regard for its effect on others in the family? I want you to stop and think. Is there someone who you always want to tell them the truth, but you have no thought about how to tell it as far as what would be helpful for them? This is really what Paul talks about, right? Speaking the truth in love. What does that mean? And I hear so many people say speaking the truth in love says, well, you got to tell them they're wrong. How do we do that to build them up?
You got to make sure there's secure attachment.
Yes, right? That's underneath it all. It has to be done in love. In what ways is our family, the church, wanting to tell the truth within the family without regard for its effect on others? So, talking about the family, how does the church itself look like Joseph at this point? We want to tell the truth to one another, but we have no regard for how it's going to affect them.
Oh, when we tell you what you can't do.
Yes, or to shun you, right? Or to say, well, that no, you can't believe that, or you can't feel that way, or...
You can't belong to us if you feel that way.
Yes, so that idea is this idea of, yes, we are to tell the truth, and we are to build one another up, and the two are not mutually exclusive. They have to be together. This is Joseph's whole idea, right? He's got a good character. He's got a character of generosity. And so that's what we're going to do then as we, when we take down, I didn't think about how I'm going to take these down. We take down all of the patriarchs and we're going to start putting up Joseph's character. But what we're going to see is Joseph's character starts out immature. So we're going to start out with this idea of him being generous. But it's an immature generosity. And that's what God is going to have to strengthen, right? So Joseph is generous. He wants to tell the truth. He wants to give of himself. Like, think about a little kid wanting to tell somebody their dream and how exciting it is. And you'll see even more why that would be so exciting for him. But the idea is it's immature, and God needs to strengthen that. He needs to bake that to a place where it is actually helpful for others and connected to love. So, John tells us that if someone says, I love God, but hate my brother, you are a liar. You cannot love God whom you haven't seen when you can't love your brother whom you have seen. That's the whole story that we have here with the brothers. So we have to ask, are we willing to allow God to strengthen our generous truth-telling character through the baking process, either individually or corporately. So that's Joseph. We get to Jacob, and we know that Jacob loves Joseph more than all the others. And it says, because he was the son of his old age. So, unfortunately, Jacob is still immature here too, because it's about him, right? With Joseph, he didn't have to feel shame about modeling an independent, self-reliant lifestyle. All the other brothers are much older than Joseph. And so they have grown up under a father who has been self-reliant, right? Joseph was very young when Jacob's character was molded and changed. And Jacob doesn't have to feel shame about now with Joseph. That's one of the reasons he loves Joseph. It indicates an immature character. God has molded Jacob from anxious, self-reliant schemer to a dependent truth teller. But he hasn't grown enough yet to give out the love and attention that God has given him to all of his sons and daughters. It doesn't say he doesn't love his sons and daughters at all. It just says he loves Joseph more. And he's not, he is unaware of what he's doing. So, of course, he gives him, he makes him a, depending on what your translations say, a colored robe. So the word colored actually isn't in there. The word that's actually there is a long-sleeved, long-length robe. With most likely embroidery on it, which is probably where they're going to get that. But the problem is, if you don't have long-sleeved, long-length, you don't understand what this is. So it's a long, all the way to the ground, and long sleeves. That's the robe that is given to Joseph. A long-sleeved, long-length robe designates management rather than laborer. Exactly. You can't work in long sleeves and long coat. So it puts Joseph in charge of all of his brothers as they shepherd, which makes Jacob completely oblivious to Joseph's immaturity and how all the rest of the brothers see Joseph. Probably because he's oblivious to his own immaturity. So this long coat, it's not practical for working in, because he's the management. But it also would be immediately recognizable as the one who is directing the operation. Not only of the family, but people outside of the family would see he's the one who's directing the operation. So it's a symbol of status over his brothers, not simply an emotional affection. It is, Joseph is valued more than the others, in both the family circle and in the community, right? Because his father is saying, I value him as management. So his immaturity, Jacob's immaturity, has moved him toward some people, Joseph, God, but not toward the rest of his family. And that is revealed as the reason for the brothers' shame, for their shame responses, for their anxiety. They saw that their father loved Joseph more than them. Ah, that's where the anxiety is coming from. All this time. So they hated him. Remember, disordered shame causes us to judge another. And it's usually someone who is close to us rather than the one who actually disrupted the relationship. So they're closer to Joseph in everyday life than they are to the father. And it also says that the brothers could not speak to him in peaceable terms. Remember, what does it come out? When judgment comes out, it comes out as criticism or condescension in words. That's exactly what's happening here. So we see now why the disordered shame responses are coming out, because of how Jacob is actually handling his relationships with his sons. Lastly, we look at the brothers. We see them hating Joseph. Hate, this word hatred here is to see someone as an enemy. So they see Joseph as an enemy because of his father's favoritism. And they hated Joseph even more because of Joseph's immature truth-telling. And then it says they were jealous of Joseph. So their anxiety has moved to hatred, has moved to jealousy or envy. jealousy is the threat of losing a valued relationship to a rival. Remember, they see him as an enemy, as a rival. And it comes out of a lack of trust, which breeds insecurity. So they don't have a secure attachment with their dad, and therefore they're going to see Joseph as the enemy. You're the one causing all of this. And so we understand that their envy makes them resent so much that they want to destroy it. So this isn't covetousness. Covetousness is about, I want something so bad I'll steal it. Envy is, I resent so much that I want to destroy. And that's what's happening here with Jacob's brothers, with Joseph's brothers. The brother's envy is of the father's love, the father's assignment to him as over them, but ultimately about God's plans. And it results in bitterness and anger actually against God. And you'll see that as we get to the dream part. The brothers can't go against the father because that's too much to lose. They can't go against God. How can you go against God? I mean, even Laban says, I can't go against your God. So they turn their bitterness on Joseph. So here we see what God has to work with, right? Now we're going to look at God's work. We're going to look at God's windy work and then his incorporating work. So his windy work. Why do I call it windy work? Remember we talked about looking at the effects of the Spirit's work. So we have to look at the effects. So we don't even see God mentioned in 37, but we see the effects of the Spirit working. Dreams. So let's talk about dreams in A&E times. They came from the divine realm, so they were taken seriously. In other words, they did not think that dreams came from your own thoughts. Dreams came from the gods. The gods were revealing themselves to a person, often filled with symbolism. So they needed interpreters. And like you said, who said that Israel doesn't seem to need interpreters? All throughout Scripture, Israel doesn't need interpreters for dreams because Israel's in connection with God. They don't need interpreters. Often dreams are obvious enough that anyone could interpret them. But most of the times, Scripture will show Israel as the ones who's able to recognize what the dreams mean. But Israel's never needing to go somewhere for an interpretation. There is one time, now, and I'm thinking about it, and I think it's Saul who goes and asks, but Saul is walking away from his, and he goes to the world to say, what does this dream mean? Dreams were the most common form of divine revelation for the uninitiated. In other words, for those who weren't in professions of professional ministry. I don't know what else to call it. You know, as priests wouldn't have gotten their information about from the gods from dreams. They would have gotten other ways, oracles and things like that. Dreams would have come from the uninitiated. And right here, Joseph is uninitiated. He's not yet having this really intimate connection with God. So if we're going to read in context the dreams, we need to understand that what the author is saying is, reader, pay attention. God's working here, right? Because the A&E people, as soon as they saw dreams, they would go, oh, wait, God's working. God's here. God's doing something here. They wouldn't need the word Elohim to be there or Yahweh to be there. They would understand that. So we as the reader have to recognize God's working in the background here. The Spirit's moving. So let's track where else we're going to see the Spirit moving. What else is happening that is out of man's control? So that's how we're going to start tracking how the Spirit's moving. Now, eventually, it's going to come right out and say, God was with Joseph. God gave Joseph favor. But here, we have to start tracking. The author of Scripture always assumes that we're willing to think through this. We want it easy. Mm-hmm. And the Spirit says, why would I make your brain not work if I've given you a brain? Work. Let it work. You're not little babies, right? I mean, New Testament talks about it all the time. So look and see what other things are happening that are under man's control. So you're supposed to be looking for that. So Joseph's dream. Okay, we all know what the dream is. The sheaves all bow down to his own sheave. indicating, of course, that the brothers and then the father and mother are going to be subordinate to Joseph. When they, all the brothers understand that dream, they don't, it doesn't have to be interpreted, but they would have assumed, as Joseph would have assumed, that that was information only for the family context. They never would have assumed that that meant he was going to go somewhere else and be over them. It just meant within the family context. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Right? So that's all they're thinking. But he's already been given a position of authority mm-hmm. in the family. And what the brothers are really mad about with this dream, which even the Andrew Lloyd Webber song goes, is, well, wait a second. Yes, Jacob gave him that, and we're already so upset with Jacob, but now God is telling. Mm-hmm. And that is really irritating them. And that's why I say the bitterness is really underneath it all toward God. God is pointing, wait, God is making Joseph over us? No way. So we have God's windy work. We see him blowing through with this dream. We'll see it elsewhere as we go on. But then we also see God's incorporating work. I'll talk about what I mean by that in a minute. But we see now, after the dream, the brothers go and shepherd, and Joseph is given a task by his father. And his task is, go to see about the welfare of your brothers. Where are they?
Shechem.
In Shechem. They're in Shechem. What in the world? They're in Shechem. And so, of course, what we understand is that Jacob is probably a little bit nervous about their external safety, right? They're going back to Shechem. It's only been probably around 10 years or so since they completely slaughtered the city. Yes, it's been revived and there's more people there. But believe me, people know that these are the ones who did that. And so, of course, Jacob is probably very nervous. And so he sends Joseph to go see about their external safety. But underneath it, Jacob knows what kind of men his sons are. And he may be wondering whether their anxiety is going to continue to rear its head in aggressive action, right? They're going to Shechem. What's going to happen now? So Jacob wants to send Joseph to look after their welfare. But when a brother is going to look after their welfare, you better start thinking back in the rest of Genesis, right? I mean, it sure sounds like God going to Cain. Mm-hmm. Where's your brother? Mm-hmm. You're supposed to be looking after. Am I my brother's keeper? God is basically saying yes, mm-hmm. yes. Adam and Eve, where are you? He's not looking for where they are physically. Where are you emotionally? Where are you thinking? Where's your head? All these ideas. What it's foreshadowing here is that Joseph will be his brother's keepers. Right? His brother's keeper. That's the whole story of Joseph. He's going to be the brother's keeper. And that's what he's being tasked by Jacob to do. Go be your brother's keeper. So we have Jacob going to Shechem. It is about a 3 to 4 days journey for Jacob, for Joseph. That would be like us driving to San Diego to find this group. Anywhere in San Diego, I don't know. And so Joseph gets there and he's wandering. He has no idea. He's out there and he's looking. And he has no idea. So he's wandering. So again, Joseph is still young. He's 17. Mm-hmm. And he's supposed to look for a needle in a haystack, basically. Where am I going to find my brothers? And a stranger just happens to come along. A stranger from Shechem. And he sees Joseph wandering without the means to know where to go. The timing of this stranger's arriving on the scene, as well as the initiative of the stranger. So you look like you're looking for something. What are you looking for? Tells the reader, oh, the spirit is moving here. This is something that doesn't just happen. God is actually working behind the scenes once again, directing Joseph's steps without him even being aware. So as a reader, you have to get a little bit thoughtful through all these. Oh, this is another place that the spirit is working. And the stranger just happened to overhear the brother's conversation. Okay, don't read that and go on. Oh, wait a second. The spirit again. Here we have the idea that the spirit is working, directing him to where the brothers are. And Dothan is like 12 miles north of there. So it's it's another one of these, wow, God is making sure that Joseph finds his brothers by a stranger from Shechem, of all people. This is what, for the history of the church, has been called providence. Providence is God's working behind the scenes, God's concurrence, working in and through his creatures and his creation to bring about what he has planned. That's what providence is called. So providence doesn't mean that you're depersonalizing. It's the behind the scenes working of God, making sure his plans get activated. So Joseph tasked, and now we have the brothers' plot. The brothers recognize Joseph a long way off. How do they recognize him a long way off? He's wearing a long coat. Oh boy, there is our brother Joseph. Of course, that's not what they say, Joseph. They don't call him that. Their initial response is revenge. Let's kill him. So Jacob's fears about their anxiety pushing them toward aggressive action. Mm-hmm. Yep, he was right. Mm-hmm. They're still operating under anxiety. And they call Joseph not by his name nor by their relationship, but by their own resentment. There is the dreamer. And actually, the word is master of dreams. So this, here's the master of dreams. And it is all their resentment in there. And they have this plan that they seem to all agree on. Let's kill him. Take what is not theirs. Let's throw him into a pit. Hide him. Let's lie about it. A wild beast ate him, when they're actually the wild beasts. That will take care of his dreams. In other words, our future will no longer be in jeopardy. It is the microcosm of everything that anxiety does, right? Anxiety deceives, anxiety steals in order to secure their own future. That's exactly what's happening right here, right in just two little conversations. And then we have Reuben come in. So we already know about Reuben. He's already tried to get his own future. And now he says, let's not take his life. Let's just throw him into the pit. And what we need to understand is, and we need to question, what in the world is he doing here, right? He says so that he could go and rescue him and restore him to his father.
Oh, he's going to be a good guy.
Okay, but why? First of all, he's the oldest, so he has a responsibility to protect, right? But is that what he's doing? Is he trying to protect Joseph? No. He doesn't intend to restore him to his brothers. That's where the restoration needs to happen, right? Between the brothers, not him and Jacob. It's between him and his brothers. Right. He's not offering to do that. If he was, he would say, wait, he's our brother. Let's not harm him. Which says that Reuben's plan is actually self-motivated. Why? Because he's on the outs with his dad. He's stolen his concubine. Oh, this is a way for me to get back into the good graces of dad. The ambiguous wording actually allows us to be able to take that out, because it says, Reuben did this to restore him to his father. Mm. Oh, not Joseph, himself. Mm. That's what Reuben is doing. So it seems like the brothers actually follow Reuben's suggestion. They throw him in the pit, but they throw him into the pit without water, and they strip him of his robe. Now, if they want to do what Reuben wants to do, let's save him, right? Let's not do harm to him, really. Joseph can't go home to Jacob without his jacket, without implicating his brothers, right? He's got to have the jacket. So the fact that they strip him of his jacket, of his status, already tells you their intention is not to just do a little harm. Their intention is actually that he die. Why? They put him into the pit without water. They want him to die of thirst. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, we don't have to actually stab him. Let's just put him in the pit and he'll die. It's not to rescue him. They have absolutely no regard for Joseph, because they sit down and eat while Joseph is in the pit crying for help. How do we know that? The text doesn't say he's crying for help. Oh, when we get at the end of the story, in I think chapter 42, the brothers will say, Didn't our hearts bother us when we heard Joseph's cry in the pit? Mm. Oh, yes. Joseph is crying here, and they're sitting down eating. They're having a great feast while Joseph is in the pit. So that's, although they, it seems like they take Reuben's suggestion, they really don't. They don't want to rescue him. They don't want to just do a little bit to him. They want to kill him. And then we have providence continuing, because it says, behold, a caravan. It says they look up their eyes, they lift up their eyes. Anytime a character in the scripture lifts up their eyes, we know we're talking about, oh, we see God working. Behold, usually is a, oh, God's working. A caravan just happens to pass by. Now, yes, they are on a road that caravans would have gone. But here, at the right time, just as they throw him into the pit, oh, a big caravan comes. And the caravan happens to be full of Ishmaelites and then Midianites, who are relatives. Not only are they relatives, but they are traders, and they're not warriors, right? Because it could have been the Edomites, who are warriors. But no, it's traders. And so we have this providential happening of the caravan of traders coming along. We won't go into each of these things, but what we see then, again, is just at the right time, the right type of people came along. People who are not only relatives, but who are traders rather than warriors. And then we have Judah going, ah, he sees an opportunity to profit. And so we have this deceptive rationalization. Hey, you know what? He's our brother, our own flesh. Let's just sell him. Which is so, it's so funny. Hey, he's our brother. Let's sell him. I mean, the two don't go together, right? Who sells their brother? Judah treats Joseph as a slave, not a brother. 20 shekels is the typical price for any slave. So it's not even a very fancy slave. It's just a normal, common, everyday slave. The profit that they're each going to get is 2 shekels. It's a month's wage. They are very rich, by the way. Their whole family is very wealthy. For them to get a month wage is like nothing. They're not really getting much out of this. It's just a way to be able to cover their own tracks. So the brothers listen to Judah. And so what we see is Judah is actually the one who's leading the brothers, not Reuben. They're the ones who the brothers listen to. And that begins as the reader's reading going, oh, okay, what's going to happen here? Judah's acting more like the leader than Reuben is. Reuben wanted the exact same thing, right? Don't kill him. But he wasn't courageous enough to protect Joseph against violence. He's even left the scene. So he's leaving Joseph's life in the hands of the ones who wanted to kill him. So Reuben's leadership is completely decimated here. And Reuben comes back. He finds Joseph not there, and he's in dismay. And the thing he says is, where am I to go now? I can't go back to my father. I can't show my face. So there's where you go, oh, it was about you, wasn't it? It wasn't. If it was about Joseph, was there something else he could have done?
He could have bought him back.
He could have run after him, right? He could have done any of those. But it's, now where am I going to go? Oh, woe is me, rather than woe is Joseph. And so what we have here then is a disruption of the family. We have a familiar deception because we have them killing a goat, dipping Joseph's coat in the goat's blood to deceive Jacob. Well, isn't that interesting? Because isn't Jacob use a goat's hair and goat's meat to deceive his own father? Oh, yeah. And so we see the consequences still happen. Even though Jacob's character has changed, he is now being deceived by his own sons. And Jacob mourns for Joseph many days. And the whole family colludes in deception by trying to comfort Jacob. I mean, it wasn't enough to not tell him that he's not dead, but now they're tearing their clothes. Oh, poor Oh, Dad, we're sorry. No, so we have this colluding in deception. But Jacob refuses to be comforted, and he basically promises, I will never stop mourning my son till the day I die. That is another push away for the rest of the brothers, right? You don't matter to me. It's only Jacob. My whole life is ruined because I've lost the one son that I loved the most. So the family ends up more disconnected than it was at the very beginning of the chapter. Why in the world does God allow that? because it's the family's response to shame that needs to be cultivated rather than behavior. Shame responses are a function of how we collaborate or don't collaborate within our relationships. Experiences of shame give us opportunities to choose either for relationship or against relationship. Anytime we feel shame, it's always a question of, do you want to move toward the relationship or do you want to move away from it? And what we call shame responses, disordered shame responses, we move away. When we move toward, an ordered shame response will lead to connection and growth and maturity. It'll actually integrate our brain, physiologically actually integrate our brain as well as our whole being. Disordered shame responses, though, lead us to movement away from others and toward disintegration of our brains and our maturity. So God is giving them this opportunity so that they can mature. It's Jesus' ultimate victory, right? In Hebrews, it tells us that it is because of the joy that was set before him, right? Joy only comes out of perichoretic relationship. That's what overflows. Because of that, he endured the cross, despising the shame. Despising meaning, I am not going to allow shame to make me move away from it, from relationship. Even though these people are saying, I'm not valuable, I will move toward them because the joy of relationship is worth it that will come. So in the face of shame, he said, I'm not going to allow it to move me away. I will move toward it for the goal of relationship. God's character work then in his family is meant to mold and strengthen them into a radically different kind of humanity. Ones whose natural shame response will be to move toward others, no matter the circumstances. What we see then at the very end of 37 is that providence is still in control. God's spirit working is still in control because it says, meanwhile, I love that. Meanwhile, God is bringing Joseph safely to Egypt to a new life. The reader knows, oh, the story's going to continue. This isn't the end. They're not, God's not done with them. Neither Joseph's immaturity or the brothers' self-significant schemes have rid themselves of God's planned future. It's still there. Strangely, their disordered, emotional-led actions will take them to God's telos. That seems so strange. Which reminds us that God gives us freedom to choose to move away from relationship and him, but his ultimate goal is still going to be achieved, whether we move away or not. It will be a matter of whether we continue to kick at the goat or we partner with him. That determines whether we experience the good of that goal. So a quick summary. God works behind the scenes. That's providence, right? He made sure Joseph found his brothers. He made sure he put his picture out there for them. He makes sure that friendly traders happen by. Secondly, God's work is character building. Neither Joseph or Jacob or his brothers are highlighted as models to emulate. Instead, the reader's directed to pay attention to where God's working and what God is working with. The intention of God's character work is not to simply give us a smattering of his character. He will not leave us with just a small reflection of his glory and say, oh, that's good enough. As with Joseph, we will see he will take an immature generosity that gives without discernment or concern for the other and move it toward the oven that he might bring it from one level of glory to another. Oh, nice molded piece, but it's not edible. Put in the oven, it's going to become edible. Right, Paul tells us, we all are being transformed into the same image from one level of glory to the next level of glory. God is not going to leave us molded in an immature character. He's going to strengthen us. Thirdly, God doesn't waste anything. The choices that come from our disordered or immature emotions are not eliminated or discarded. Jacob's immature generosity, Joseph's immature generosity, the brothers' self-serving schemes, he's going to use them to further the purposes he's already decided on. God's incorporation of disorder shows us that devouring does not mean spitting out. That's what I think we always think. No. We think God's going to devour. He's going to take that disorder and go, ugh. No, he takes it. He consumes it. And within the consumption of it, within the devouring of it, he actually turns it into something useful, right? We do that with all food. We take it in and it becomes energy. That's what God does with disorder. He doesn't go, oh, I can't use that. Ugh, let's get it out. He actually devours it and transforms it into something useful. That's what he's going to do with the disorder in Jacob's family. Lastly, paying attention to God's work will mean recognizing our own immature character. First seen by our lack of love for one another within the family of Christ, both individually and corporately, by our words, whether they're inside of us or they come out, by our active shame responses of distancing from others in the church, which in effect is to leave them to die to thirst. Letting God incorporate our disordered character actions and choices is the means that he will use to strengthen us to the role of brother's keeper. Now may the God of peace equip you in every good thing to do his will, working in us that which is pleasing in his sight, through Jesus Christ, to whom belongs the glory forever and ever. Amen. Amen.